You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. John Boehner, contrary to my predictions, I thought Eric Cantor was going to pull it off. John Boehner was just coronated? What do you call it, coronation? Re-enthroned as the Speaker of the House. So, you know, we're not going to quite get the clown show I was hoping for over the next 2 years. I thought it'd be fascinating to have Eric Cantor and Kevin McCarthy running the House. But John Boehner just has, you know, way too much common sense for me. And that's a pretty shocking statement, I suppose. Okay. And in the midst of this, there's this debate about taxes and spending cuts. You know, basically at the end of the year, taxes went up over the next decade by somewhere between $5 and $6 trillion. The legislation that was passed to cut those taxes, including cutting taxes from 39.6% down to 20% for billionaires who earn their money as capital gains and carried interest, chopped that down to under $1 billion or under $1 trillion. But it was between $5 and $6 trillion. Excuse me if I said billion. This is apropos of some part of America's history. In 1776, the state of Pennsylvania was putting together their constitution. Article 16, this is from Wealth and Democracy, Kevin Phillips' brilliant book. Article 16 of the Pennsylvania Bill of Rights, quote, "An enormous proportion of property vested in a few individuals is dangerous to the rights and destructive of the common happiness of mankind, and therefore every free state hath a right by its laws to discourage the possession of such property." Thomas Jefferson himself, writing to Samuel Kercheval in 1816, said, "Those seeking profits, were they given total freedom, would not be the ones to trust to keep government pure and our rights secure. Indeed, it has always been those seeking wealth who are the source of corruption in government. No other depositories of power have ever yet been found which did not end in converting to their own profit the earnings of those committed to their charge." And in fact, he went on, "If an overgrown wealth of an individual be deemed dangerous to the state, the best corrective is the law of equal inheritance to all in equal degree." Are billionaires dangerous to our democracy? On the line with me is Diana Birchgott-Roth, a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute and former chief economist with the U.S. Department of Labor. Manhattan-institute.org is the website. Diana, welcome back to the program.
Great to be with you.
Thank you. So, I'm fine with somebody having, and we're talking here wealth, not income, what they own. I'm fine with somebody having $1 million or $100 million or $500 million or $900 million or even $999 million, even though it's inconceivable that anybody could spend that much money personally. And we're talking personal wealth here, not corporate wealth.
Well,
in their lifetime.
Bill Gates seems to do a pretty good job.
Well, he's not spending it though.
Yeah, he set up a foundation in order to give it out. He's giving out a lot to health. He's giving out a lot to education. He's somebody who is really making people better off, I think.
So you're making the argument for aristocracy. I mean, that was the argument that traditionally was made in Europe for having kings and queens, was that they endowed the arts, they endowed the museums, they built the cathedrals, therefore we need them.
I think what you mean is patronage. Aristocracy is when wealth goes from one generation to another.
Well, the patronage is a dimension of aristocracy.
Bill Gates was the first one in his family who made that kind of money.
But if he...
Patronage is, I think, the word you're looking for.
You're absolutely right. And if there is not a substantial Paris Hilton tax on him when he dies, then the next generation is going to be aristocracy.
That's right. Yes, exactly.
And for, you know, a fair number of billionaires in America, it's already aristocracy. So, again, I mean, aren't you making the argument for the old-fashioned, you know, feudal or semi-feudal European-style aristocracy or patronage system?
Well, coming from Europe, I can really see the difference because there are dukes and duchesses and counts. They have inherited land. They were given it by the king. They didn't earn it themselves. Here we have people who earn their money, who perhaps pass it on. But, you know, there's a saying, from rags to riches and back again in three generations. You often find people who inherit wealth and who then don't use it properly.
I think the Rockefeller family might disagree with you.
even more important than that, I think it's important that people have the right to earn what they earn. They've earned it legally. They have a right to do with it as they want, to pass it on to other generations. You find that new millionaires and billionaires come up, like Bill Gates and Eric Schmidt of Google. Why is that? Because they have a good idea, and people have a good idea.
No, they don't.
Who can sell it to the public?
That's
they
not the case.
The return.
Bill, first of all, Bill Gates didn't have a good idea. He bought that. He bought the original operating system from a fellow who had developed it. He was a good marketer.
Yeah, but he knew how to do it.
And then secondly, he's a welfare queen.
He knew
queen.
To buy it.
He's a total
he
welfare
to make
queen.
The investment, and he worked very hard. He got up as a teenager in the middle of the night, went to the computer labs at the University of Washington, went back to bed. Then his mother was wondering why it was always so hard to wake him up in the morning. He worked very hard. The same with Steve Jobs. And Steve Jobs had the idea. He didn't invent the technology. The technology came from abroad. But he knew that if you put this technology in this little device that was a bit bigger than a credit card, people would want to walk around carrying all their music on.
Well, and the original operating system that Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak used for the Apple computer had originally actually been developed, I believe it was by Hewlett-Packard. It was the old Star operating system. But in any case, I would say that what you're saying is not actually the case. Bill Gates is a welfare queen, as is Steve Jobs, or was Steve Jobs. These guys,
he's a welfare queen?
Yes, absolutely.
So.
They are subsidized by government fiat. And this was the argument that Jefferson made strongly, repeatedly, and why for the first 100 years, the first century of America, we did not have patent laws that extended more than a dozen years or so, was that if our patent laws extended more than 3 years, and copyright laws for that matter, but in particular patent laws, that what would happen was innovation would stop and fortunes would start to accumulate in the hands of the first people who got into a marketplace, and they would create basically, you know, oligarchies. And that's exactly what Bill Gates did with Microsoft.
Well, there are many technologies that rise and fall, many big stores that are popular one time and then 5 or 10 years later they're not popular at all. Look at everyone was buying IBM computers at one point. Now IBM is in a different business. So you have to work pretty hard to keep even as long as there's freedom of entry. Very important that there's freedom of entry, that people have the right to come up with their new ideas, and they also have the right to get rich.
But freedom of entry,
and they have the right to spend their money on whatever.
No, wait a minute. I'm saying it's not their money. I'm saying that Bill Gates got his wealth by being a welfare queen, by depending upon the state defending a copyright or a patent that is a total abstraction and that was extended as much as it's extended and as heavily as it's extended, largely by lobbying from companies like Microsoft.
You're just jealous. Why didn't you think of that idea?
I am.
You're just sorry you didn't think of the idea and you couldn't become a welfare queen.
Well, you know, maybe you're doing some intense projection here, Diana. I am not at all jealous of Bill Gates. It's, you know, but, you know, you're entitled to your opinion. I have no problem with somebody having up to $1 billion in wealth. But it really seems to me that after $1 billion, we've reached that point that Jefferson talked about where it becomes destructive to democracy.
I disagree. As long as there's freedom of entry and other people can come and earn those amounts of money,
but there isn't.
Then that's fine.
But there isn't. America, you know, pre-Reagan, America was a country filled with small businesses. Every town's downtown was small, locally owned businesses. Every mall was small, locally owned businesses.
Look, people have
medium-sized
ideas
businesses.
Now. Look at Mark
Reagan
Zuckerberg.
Stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act, and that all went away.
Look at Mark Zuckerberg with Facebook. He had an idea.
He's a welfare queen.
Marketed the idea, and now he's a billionaire too.
He patented and copyrighted it. He's a welfare queen. He's using federal law to prevent other people from competing.
You're just jealous. Why don't you do the same and be a billionaire too?
This is not about me. This is about what's best for the republic. I don't think it would be best for me to do it either, Diane.
But I don't think you could do it either.
Well, you may well be right, but I don't think it would be right. I mean, this is one of the things that I wouldn't do. Anyhow, Diana Furchtgott Roth with the Manhattan Institute. Thank you, Diane.
Great to be with you. Bye.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back. Should we outlaw billionaires? I'm basically saying let's impose a wealth tax of 100% on every dollar, personal dollar, not corporate, past the first grade. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, the place where despair is not an option. Yeah, roughly $300 billion in austerity set to hit us this year, just based on previous. I mean, you know, there was almost $2 trillion in spending cuts that were agreed to last year by Congress. Now, that was $2 trillion spread out over the next 10 years. So a couple hundred billion dollars of that is going to hit us this year. So we are entering an era of austerity more severe than, at least in terms, not necessarily in terms of GDP, but in terms of aggregate dollars, certainly, more severe than any of the countries of Europe. And what has austerity done to Greece? Wiped them out. What did it do to Spain? Wiped them out. What did it do to the UK? They're in a double dip recession. What did it do to Ireland? Wiped them out. Portugal wiped them out. So you look at the countries that have embraced austerity, they're in big trouble. You look at the countries that said no to austerity, Sweden, Switzerland, Denmark, France, Germany, Iceland, Denmark, I think I listed Denmark, Norway, they're doing fine, thank you very much. The countries that have embraced the opposite of austerity, that have said, we're not even going to talk about austerity. Instead, we're going to give everybody in the country free health care. China did that last year. We're going to build a national infrastructure. We're going to build thousands of miles of 300-mile-an-hour rail, high-speed rail, state-of-the-art, best in the world, maglev trains. Again, China. We're going to create an infrastructure, high-speed internet, high-speed broadband, electric power. We're going to lead the world in the production and use of solar power. China. Not us. I mean, it used to be the United States that did these things. We're going to put a man on the moon in 10 years. We did. We're going to defend freedom and liberty around the world, fight World War I and World War II. Still not sure why we fought World War I, but World War II, we knew who Hitler was. And we don't so much do that anymore. And you know, not that I'm saying that we should have wars, but the point is that we knew how to mobilize when we needed to do something. We knew how to pull together when we needed to do something. We used to know in the United States how to build things, how to build the interstate highway system. Dwight Eisenhower did it. How to build highways, how to build schools, how to build hospitals, how to develop new technologies, how to create free education, how to build an intellectual infrastructure. Right up until the Reagan administration, most people went to college relatively cheaper for free. They could work their way through college at a minimum wage job. Through college, right up until the 80s. When Ronald Reagan came into office, more than 80% of the cost of higher education as a national average. Now, it was 100% in California. It was, you know, probably 60% in Mississippi. But the national average was around 80% was paid for by federal and state and local money. And roughly 20% of the cost of education was paid for by tuition. And we had been doing that for decades, arguably for centuries. And then came Reagan and, you know, Bill Bennett as the head of the Department of Education and this whole, oh, let's have for-profit schools, let's start paying, you know, it's just, and it went nuts. And then let's say that student loans can't be used for bankruptcy. In other words, you can't get away from them. Oh, the banks would love to lend you that. Right, something you can never declare bankruptcy on. Their risk is zero or close to zero. And they can try and they can borrow from the federal government right now at 0.25%, and they can lend to students at 6-7%. And they can make some serious money. So what happens? The cost of education explodes. Now, state and federal spending, it's flipped. State and federal spending now represents a little less than 30%. It's not the 20%, but it's a little less than 30%. It's in the high 20s. And tuition represents in the neighborhood of 70% of the total cost of education. So we have flipped it upside down in just 32 years. And much of that flip happened in the 80s and mid-90s, although it's continuing. It's a trend that's continuing. So you add that to this explosion of the billionaire class, and it's like, is this really the country we want, where we can't afford to educate our kids because the billionaires are taking all the money, the welfare queens like Bill Gates, you know, and whatnot, they're taking all the money, and using laws like copyright and patent laws and so-called free trade laws to be and the capital gains loophole to take billions and billions of dollars out of their companies. And stash it in Swiss bank accounts. I mean, how many did Mitt Romney have in the Caymans? And these, and then, you know, they hire Frank Luntz and he says, oh yeah, let's call these people the job creators. This is like when the Walton heirs, the five Walton heirs who own more wealth than 30% of Americans, the bottom 30% of Americans own less than five Walton heirs. Sam Walton, Walmart. These are not people who earned their income. They inherited it or earned their wealth. And, you know, they funded this campaign secretly. It took us almost a decade to discover that they had paid for it. A multi-million dollar campaign over a number of years to rebrand the estate tax, what I call the Paris Hilton tax, as the, and what sometimes was called the, well, typically, it was called the estate tax or the inheritance tax sometimes, to rebrand it as the so-called death tax. It's not a tax on death. It's a tax on money that's transferred after somebody has died. But it's really a tax on the transfer of assets, which we do all the time. You go into a store and you buy a candy bar, it's a transfer of assets. And you pay a sales tax. You buy a car, you pay a tax. You buy a house, you pay a tax. I mean, hand somebody a bunch of money, you pay a tax on it. So I'm suggesting, and Diana is British, she would know that in the UK, they actually, I don't think they do anymore, but they used to have, and they do in many European countries, a wealth tax. Every year, part of your wealth is paid in tax.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So I'm suggesting we should have a wealth tax. It shouldn't kick in until $1 billion, and after that it should be 100%. We've discussed this before. What do you think?
Damn it, man. Is there anything you don't know?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week for we the people of the United States of America. Of the, you know, for all life on Earth. Let's leave it at that. We the people can't exist if our planet isn't functional. And increasingly, we're making our planet dysfunctional. And one of the things that's causing that dysfunction is the aggregation of mind-boggling wealth in ways that are not particularly healthy for our society, the accumulation of it in ways that are not particularly healthy, and then the maintenance of it in ways that are not particularly healthy. Can you imagine walking into a kindergarten class and seeing one kid with half the room, and he's got a whole pile of toys all the way up to the ceiling, like a Scrooge McDuck money bin. And then there's like four or five kids who each have two or three toys. And then there's like a crowd of maybe 20 or 30 kids who have one toy that they're, you know, trying to play with. That's the distribution of wealth in the United States right now. It's really quite extraordinary when you consider it. I've got some the actual specifics here. This is we are at a point in time where the split is the greatest it has ever been in our history. We're back where it's as bad as or worse than it was during the Great Depression that was referred to as the Gilded Age, which was great for the, you know, a few of what would in today's dollars would be billionaires, and we just learned that last year, 2012, one heck of a year for billionaires, the 100 richest people in the world got $241 billion wealthier. And in the United States, American billionaires, there's $200 billion of that. So $41 billion was outside the United States. $200 billion wealthier. Net worth of American billionaires, $1.7 trillion. And, you know, if that created an economy that works, and a country that works, I wouldn't object to it, but all the evidence indicates that no, it doesn't so much. It does not. So what do we do? You know, Time magazine back in 1966 said, here we are. The typical hourly wage for an American worker has increased in the last 36 years, basically since Reagan, has increased $1.23, typical hourly wage. Meanwhile, the top 1% have seen their incomes increase by 275%. This is absolutely breathtaking. So, Tracy in Amherst, Massachusetts, thanks for listening to WHMP. What's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you?
Great.
So I had a response to Diana. I listen to you every day, and I very rarely feel compelled to call, but I just wanted to say that she's basically peddling a very old rags-to-riches fantasy, but that fantasy is only slimly possible if a society isn't calcified based on class.
If there's no
social mobility, then people can't become a Bill Gates. It's not possible.
And in the era from the 1950s to the 1980s, we were the most socially mobile country in the world, and now we are, of the 34 richest countries in the world, we are number two from the bottom.
Right. Right. And that story she's peddling doesn't account for that at all. It's like she's got it exactly backwards.
Yeah. Excellent.
And of course, you know, she's turning around and saying that you're jealous, but what she's doing is apologizing and deflecting because she's pointing to these, you know, isolated cases and turning around and saying, oh, you can all be like them instead of the people born on third base who say that they hit a home run.
Yeah. I think suggesting that I'm being emotional, which, you know, jealousy is an emotion, I'm somehow, putting my hand to my forehead and wailing or jealous or whatever that looks like, just indicates the weakness of the argument. Tracy, thank you for the call, and thanks for listening to WHMP. Great, great point. Andrew in Ashland, Pennsylvania. Hey, Andrew.
How you doing, Tom?
Great. Facebook's, Google's?
Originally, I was calling about, I'm sorry?
I said Facebook's, Google's, you wanted to talk about?
Yeah. Originally, I was calling about this, but since you mentioned the NRA suggestion to arm the school teachers, if we leave it up to the NRA, they probably want to also arm the 60-year-old kids next. That's what we'll be able to suggest.
Well, that's the direction they're moving, isn't it? You know,
yeah.
Right now they want to arm the 23-year-old kindergarten teachers.
Yeah. So. Regarding the conversation with Diane, I mean, most of us by now realize that the strength of America is in the strength of the middle class. And now with the middle class being impoverished by these multi-billion dollar rich people, sooner or later, this country may even become unstable. There isn't among the millions of Americans, there isn't going to be a 10 million or 100 million inventors of Facebook. We only can invent one Facebook. The others will be impoverished. So we need like a system that maintains the middle class. And I don't know if anyone ever looked at the tax code to see if there is a way to frame the tax code in a way that you get tax breaks based on your payroll.
Andrew, you're buying into the Republican meme that somehow millionaires, billionaires, companies, rich people, employers make wealth. Employers don't make wealth at all. Wealth is created by workers, and demand, yeah, which is what drives economies, is created by consumers. So the real simple equation here is, if you were to go back before Reagan and take the top tax rate up above 50%, take it to the 74% it was at when Reagan came into office, or the 91% it was at during the Nixon administration, during a time when we had a strong middle class, then you wouldn't have these CEOs extracting all this wealth out of their country, out of their companies. And instead, because they, excellent point for, thank you for calling, Andrew. And instead of just, you know, taking that money out and taking it and sticking it in a Swiss bank account, they would say, well, you know, let's pay our employees a decent wage. I mean, it works, and it worked for 40 years in this country. Karen in Sheboygan, Michigan. Hey, Karen, you want to talk about the fiscal cliff? Karen?
Oh, I'm on the air?
You are on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hey, I'm glad that you've been talking about austerity today, because I am just ranting and fuming over Obama and the Democrats passing this insane compromise bill. Because for so many years when I debate our local Republicans in letters to the editor, I always point out how damaging the Bush tax cuts have been to us. And now to see Democrats passing, extending these taxes permanently through 99% of people, to me, I see that as a tribute to this austerity that you're talking about. And it sounded like, if I understood the way you were talking on it yesterday, you see it as a good deal. Can you remind me how come
what I said yesterday, and I'll repeat it again.
Right,
yeah, what I said yesterday, and I'll repeat it again, and we've got to turn up that backstream gain, is that I think that for the average American political observer, the average American, it looks like President Obama won a big victory. And that helps him, and it helps the Democrats moving forward politically. I do, however, think that in terms of economic policy, that the deal that was struck was a bad deal. And in particular, because it kept capital gains, it raised it from 15 to 20%, but it had gone up to 39.6% at midnight on December 31st, and which is where capital gains should be. The capital gains tax loophole should have expired, and they should have left it expired, so that Mitt Romney pays on the 10, 15 million, 20 million bucks he gets every year. I mean, here's a guy who's getting a $2 million paycheck or $1 million paycheck every 2 weeks, so that he pays the exact same income tax rate on it that a surgeon would pay, or somebody, a very, very highly paid, highly professional person. And instead, Mitt Romney's tax rate has gone from 15% to 20% instead of going up to 39.6%. So I was commenting on the politics and the policy. I think politically, optically, it looked good, and it's going to be sold as a victory. And the Republicans are certainly hanging on to that. They're trying to play victim about it. But they're also, to their own, locally and internally, they're saying, we won.
I'm going to start calling these the Obama tax cuts now.
It's much more complex than that, Karen. President Obama doesn't exist in a vacuum. To either blame or credit all of this to any one person would be a mistake. You have to consider the House of Representatives is run by the Republicans. They have absolute, total control over it. And with the current filibuster rules in place, they basically control the Senate. I think he probably did the best he could do with what he had. That said, I would have liked to seen a lot better, but that's my take. Karen, thank you for the call. Rob, we have just a minute here to the break in Sacramento. You had a comment, a good idea, the wealth tax?
Yeah, Tom, what do you think about tying it to a percentage of GDP rather than an arbitrary number?
Oh, that's interesting. If your wealth exceeds 1% of the U.S. GDP, then all the wealth beyond that is, that's interesting. I would have to, I wouldn't object to that because that would be kind of an inflator, an inflation indexed wealth tax, basically, as GDP grows or contracts for that matter, the wealth tax would change. Yeah, that's fine with me. Thank you, Rob. I think it ironic that we put an inflation index on the estate tax a couple of days ago, but not on the minimum wage. So rich people get to account for inflation, but not working people.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
But again, these are all the things that the Republicans demanded for even a modest deal that keeps from crashing the economy from happening. And now I believe that they're going to try and really crash the economy. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Jeff in San Francisco. Hey, Jeff. Latest fiscal cliff deal?
Hey, Tom. Yeah, I just want to get your opinion on how Obama's going to use it. He's kind of got some political capital, and how you think he might use it.
It's going to be really interesting to see, because there is an argument to be made. I've actually made it on this program that he missed some opportunities to really hold Republicans accountable and force them into situations where they would have to either hurt the country or violate what they hold as their core principles, which is never raise taxes on billionaires. And he didn't do that. On the other hand, had he done that, it could have hurt the country. And I think probably he would have ended up with most of the blame for it. So My general take is that he probably got the best deal he could get, or he got something close to that, and that the Republicans are going to hold this full faith and credit of the United States, this debt ceiling, and they're going to try and use it as a weapon against him. And it looks like he's going to use the 14th Amendment against them. All the memes that I hear coming out of the White House right now are, you know, these are bills that have already been generated. We've already put this money on the credit card. Now the credit card bill has come due and it's time to pay it. And the Republicans say we don't want to pay it. And they're questioning the full faith and credit of the United States. And if they do that, they are violating the 14th Amendment. That's unconstitutional. And as I've said many times, I think the president has the power. I believe he has the power under the Constitution to simply say to Congress, this law that you guys passed back during World War I that says that, you know, there's a credit ceiling or a ceiling on the U.S. debt is an unconstitutional law, and I'm not going to follow it. And there have been a lot of presidents over history who have said, no, I'm not going to do that. I think that there's something wrong with that law, and I think that he should do that with that. So that's my take on it, Jeff. Thanks a lot for the call. Tim in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hey, Tim, what's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. I'm calling about Diane. I was just astounded when I listened to her. I don't know why I was. I shouldn't. I mean, there are people like this all around, you know. But I just it was like an Ayn Rand flashback, you know.
Mm-hmm. Ayn Rand is alive and well. I mean, you know, she's dead, but
yeah, right,
her,
exactly.
Her philosophy is certainly alive and well.
The ramifications, I mean, you know, all right, Jobs, Gates, and Zuckerberg, these are all intelligent guys, right?
They were all what guys?
All these computer guys, you know, that have made it big, you know.
Sure.
If it wasn't for DARPA, where would they be?
If it wasn't for, you know, for DARPA?
Anybody else?
Yeah, DARPA, excellent point. DARPANET was the original military-created, government-created, government-funded thing that became what we call the Internet. You're absolutely right. And it's like things build on other things. This was Jefferson's argument for there not being a patent law that lasted more than 3 years. Because at the end of 3 years, and in fact in the Constitution, it says that the only reason that Congress can pass a law protecting patents is to advance the state of science and industry. And in other words, you know, if you lock, I would argue that by locking things up for decades, like we're doing now with patents and copyrights, we are actually retarding the forward progress of science. And that the times when this country grew the fastest and our science advanced the fastest, back during the time of Thomas Edison and whatnot, patents didn't last that long. Trademarks didn't last that long. And you know, Disney wasn't gaming the system. In fact, Disney wasn't gaming the system until after Disney was dead. And you know, tragically. So I'm with you, Tim. Thank you very much for the call. Ed in St. Clair Shores, Michigan. Hey, Ed.
Hey, Tom. I agree with you on the patent issue. I think that protecting the intellectual property rights, the period that we do, is probably detrimental to this economy and progress. But I disagree on many points, and one being that I see that the Tea Party or the conservative Republicans in Congress are the only adults in Washington, because they recognize that the survival level of this threat to this country is $120 trillion of unfunded liabilities that we currently have, not to mention the $16 trillion.
That's a nonsensical. These are nonsensical numbers, Ed. You're taking 75-year projections based on the assumption that we remain in a recession all that time, that there is no lifting of the Social Security cap, that Medicare continues to not be able to negotiate drug prices. I mean, there are so many of these things are so easily fixed that these numbers that billionaires like Pete Peterson put out, they get then picked up by the Cato Institute and the Heritage Foundation and echoed everywhere. I mean, I'm hearing this stuff on NPR yesterday morning, that these numbers are complete nonsense. Social Security is solvent. It's got a $2.7 trillion surplus. Medicare is in trouble only because Medicare Part D, because, you know, Billy Towson, who went off to take a $2 million a year job as the head of the pharmaceutical lobby, Big Pharma, pushed through a bill that said that it's illegal for the federal government to negotiate when buying prescription drugs for people, although it can negotiate when it buys them for the military. Now, tell me that makes sense.
No, Tom, because this government is $16 trillion.
No, the Tea Party wants to keep it this way. The Tea Party congressman, to a person, they want to keep Medicare Part D the way it is. They don't want the government to be able to negotiate drug prices. When that legislation got sent to the Senate, you know, and not a single Tea Partier in the House of Representatives voted for it. When Nancy Pelosi got it passed, it got sent to the Senate, and Tea Partiers in the Senate filibustered it. They want it this way because they want these programs to implode, because they want, because the banksters want to step in and say, oh, you know, there's no government program now for, you know, Social Security, for disability, for pensions, for anything. So now you got to come to us, Goldman Sachs.
Absolutely not, Tom. We have $16 trillion in debt, and your argument would carry more weight if that wasn't the case, the current debt.
That also, debt was run up by the policies of Ronald Reagan and two George Bushes.
We also know that since 2010, Social Security has been losing money, and that the $2.7
trillion... It was designed to, Ed. Read the history of it. The whole point of the Social Security Trust Fund, which didn't exist before 1982, and this is something Reagan did. I mean, you should know about this if you consider yourself a Tea Partier, was that this rabbit was going to go through the python. The boomers were going to retire. And so one generation would double pay Social Security to not only pay for their parents' retirement, but also pay for their own retirement. That double payment would be put into a trust fund, and then when they started retiring, the trust fund would be paid down to zero, back where it always was. That's the boomer generation. That trust fund has $2.7 trillion in it.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, welcome back, by the way, to the second hour of our program. They're now teaching kindergarten teachers how to shoot. Let me just follow the logic of this for a minute. This totally confounds me. 500 kids in America every year die because they find a gun in the house and they accidentally shoot themselves or one of their friends. It's about twice a day. Today, in all probability, some kid in America found a gun and shot himself. So we want to have more guns in our classrooms, right? And the one thing we know about a gun in a household is that that gun is more likely to be used against a member of that household than it is against an intruder. So why do we think that a gun in a classroom might not, you know, if the teacher forgets to lock the drawer, or of course she can't keep it in a locked drawer because the guy might come barging in at any moment. And so she's got to carry it on her hip. So what if, you know, she's got it on her hip and she walks by and a student grabs it and pulls it out and starts shooting? I mean, why wouldn't a gun in the classroom be as, you know, why wouldn't the statistics be the same? That a gun in the classroom would be more likely to be used against somebody in the classroom than against an intruder, just like a gun in the home is more likely to be used against somebody in the home than it is against an intruder. Noel Flasterstein is with us, attorney and host of The Gun Show. GunRightsForYou.com is the website. Noel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me on.
So what am I missing here? It seems to me like the only winners in this will be the NRA and the weapons manufacturers who fund them.
No, the winners will be the children, and the winners will be the teachers that now, instead of being in a legislatively mandated gun-free zone, which is designed to protect children, or that was the ideological thinking behind it, now if you have a shooter come to a place like the tragedy in Newtown, at least the teachers will have a chance to protect not only themselves, but the children that are under their care.
Columbine had two armed guards.
And you know what?
My understanding is they ran in the other direction.
Well, I guess they put self-preservation ahead of trying to protect the children. Obviously, where these mass shootings occur,
Fort Hood is where one of the mass shootings occurred. There were thousands of people on that military base. Hundreds of them were well armed. What am I missing here?
Here's what you're missing. First of all, you know, you mentioned 500 children die in a year from gun accidents. How many children die in car wrecks and auto crash fatalities? So should we go ahead?
Cars are not made for the purpose of killing people.
Yeah, but they kill more people than guns do. So, you know,
but they're not made for the purpose of killing people.
You know, a gun, if it's made for the purpose of killing, is so the individual who has a constitutional Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms is so he can protect himself.
No, so now, he can be part of a well-regulated militia to protect the freedom of the state. Read the Second Amendment. What are the first 15 words of the Second Amendment?
The Supreme Court has ruled that we, as individual citizens in the United States, have the right to keep and bear arms, whether we're in a militia or not. And that was not the intent of the framers when they put that in there. The entire intent of the framers when they included the Second Amendment was that we, as a group of people, as citizens, could protect ourselves from a tyrannical government if one ever came to power.
No, come on. You've got to cut your – it's completely upside down, Noel. I mean, you go back and read – what is it? Federalist number 29? I mean, it's one of them. Hamilton went off on this thing. No, the whole point was to protect the government. It, you know, what did George Washington do when a bunch of whiskey bootleggers decided that they were going to rise up against the government and refuse to pay their taxes? He got together an armed militia of the several different local militias and rode in there and put down Shay's Rebellion, the Whiskey Rebellion, excuse me.
And let's look at James Madison in Federalist Number 56 that acknowledged that one of the differences between America and the kingdoms of Europe is that Europe does not trust its citizens with armaments. Because our citizens were armed, it would not only protect the state, but it protects the individual people from the government. Now,
Madison does not say that in Federalist 56. You are making a wild leap of interpretation. The reason for the Second Amendment was so that we the people could defend the country, not so that we the people could take on the country. If they wanted it so that we the people could take on the country, they would have said the right to have a warship, the right to have a cannon shall not be abridged, because you can't take on a government without a cannon.
Well, you know what? There was nothing prohibiting us, if we look at the Constitution, from owning a cannon. And I agree. I think that the armaments that the American military is allowed to possess, we, the citizens, should be allowed to possess. Now, with that being said,
so you want to live in Somalia?
No, I don't want to live in
where Somalia. Where you have armed militias that have surface-to-air missiles and mortars and shoulder-propelled rocket grenades and whatever you call those things, and in some cases even half tracks. I mean, you've got armed militias in Somalia that are probably 20-30% as powerful as the actual army itself.
Well,
you want that in America?
On what you're saying, then America should be able to exist as Somalia with armed militias. No, the intent of the Second Amendment was that we, the citizens, could protect ourselves from a tyrannical government if it ever came to power. You got to remember, our country was born on revolution. And if we did not have that basic belief that we as individuals...
Our country was born on revolution against a transnational corporation and the state that was defending it.
You're wrong. If you look at the Second Amendment, as it basically says, the security of a free state, being necessary, a militia being necessary for the security of a free state by itself means nothing.
Let me read to you from the Pennsylvania Constitution, and this is what the Second Amendment was based on. This is Article Number 13 of the Constitution of the State of Pennsylvania, 1776, that the people have a right to bear arms for the defense of themselves and the state, and as standing armies in the times of peace are dangerous to liberty, they ought not to be kept up, and that the military should be kept under strict subordination to and governed by the civil power and exist as a militia.
And you said to defend themselves.
Yeah. I'm not arguing that you can't have a gun to defend yourself. What I'm saying is that, first of all, to say that the Second Amendment was put into place to give us the power to take on the FBI is historically wrong. And besides that, even if it wasn't historically wrong, it would be impossible today. And secondly, you're not going to have an armed revolution in the United States, and you wouldn't want one. We tried that in 1861, and it was a mess. It was the bloodiest war we've ever had in our history. We don't want another one. And so, A. And B, that the simple fact of the matter is that a gun in a home is more likely to be used against someone in that home than against an intruder, and why would that not be the case for a school? No.
Well, first of all, I don't know where you're getting your facts. I do know this.
Centers for Disease Control.
Well, I also know that the Centers for Disease Control also acknowledges and points out that more children die from drowning, more children die from car accidents than they do for firearms. And this is including the gang members, which, you know, I don't know we were necessarily...
Water is not designed to kill people. Cars are not designed to kill people. There's this thing called cost-benefit.
Isn't that ironic? Something that isn't designed to kill kills more people than something that exists.
Because we have all decided that we actually want transportation, and we're willing to take the risk of 20, 30, 40,000 people a year dying. And by the way, the number of people who die in car accidents has decreased every year over the last since the mid-1970s when Ralph Nader got those first safety standards put into place, even though the number of cars and the number of miles driven has increased. And the reason why is because we've made transportation safer and safer. The same cannot be said for firearms.
And we have 300 million guns in private homes in America.
And we have the highest rate of gun violence in the world.
No, we don't. We have one of the lowest crime rates in the world because there's been a proliferation
of gun violence. I said gun violence.
Crime.
I did not say crime rate. I said gun violence. But no, we're out of time. Yeah, I think we've both made our points. We'll let our listeners sort out, you know, what this is all about. GunRightsForYou.com is Noel Flasterstein's website. He's the host of The Gun Show and an attorney. Noel, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I'm telling you, this is before the House of Representatives. Well, it's coming before Congress in the next couple of days, if not the next couple of weeks. Where are we going to go with it? Welcome back, Tom Hartman, here with you. Oh, my. Complaints follow Republicans offered to deliver voters' ballots. Oh, this is an old one that I found. Anyway, so we've got a lot on the table here. And I know that we've talked about these topics some in the last few weeks, and there's a reason why they keep coming back, because these are the agendas that the Republicans are going to be pursuing in the House of Representatives and forcing through in the Senate, particularly absent serious filibuster reform by Harry Reid. Things like, you know, doing away with or ending the assault weapons ban that Dianne Feinstein is proposing. And not only that, I mean, she's proposing something that doesn't even say if you own one, you have to give it up. Because, you know, we know that what would happen? You'd have 1,000 Wacos. What's really interesting, and what most people don't know, is that, yeah, there's 300 million guns in the United States. Most of them are held by a few tens of thousands of people. We have, you know, about half the country doesn't own a gun. In fact, more than half the country doesn't, well over half the country doesn't own a gun. Of the relatively small percentage of people who do own guns, most of them own one. Guns are expensive. And they require, you know, care and maintenance and attention, and it's a responsibility. So, you know, most people don't own a gun, and most gun owners only own one. And then there's a few gun owners who own two or three or four or five. And then there is this small cohort of individuals who have done basically what David Koresh did. They've developed armories, personal armories, about 20, 30, 50, 100, 200 weapons. It's like, you know, an obsession. They call themselves collectors or aficionados, and they're developing, or survivalists, enders, end of timers. Although the Mayan calendar has come and gone, and the, you know, Y2K came and went, so what's going to be the next end of the world? I don't know, but there will be one. So, Chris, yeah, there we go. Chris, hello? In Minneapolis, listening to AM 950. Chris, you were at Fort Hood, you say?
Yes, not during the. Well, I was stationed there in the mid 90s. Mm-hmm. I was not there during the shooting. Right. And I've heard a lot of people say that, you know, Fort Hood was a proof that more guns don't help. And I'm not going to debate all that kind of stuff because that's just not it. I just want to kind of set the record straight. On any military installation, if you're not in the field, you can't have a gun.
Right, unless you're the military police.
Yeah, unless you're the military police.
But there's a fair number of military police on a military base.
About like any major city.
Okay.
So Fort Hood is basically a small town.
Right.
It is patrolled by the military police. They are a police force.
Right.
They carry their sidearms. They have their long guns in their vehicles. And those unfortunately, those young soldiers that were shot down were actually standing in line. They were just waiting to, they were doing some pre-deployment stuff.
That's pretty tragic. But, yeah, you know, but my point is that even, well, first of all, Fort Hood is probably not a good example, A, for the reason that you bring up, and B, for the reason that, you know, everybody in the military has been trained in how to use a weapon.
I agree with you 100% there, but I just keep hearing people use that as a, as part of their argument.
Okay.
And I just, I,
okay.
You know what
point
I mean?
Noted. Point noted. And well made. Thank you very much, Chris. I appreciate the call. I still think it's crazy to be arming kindergarten teachers. Just crazy. Marty in Downers Grove, Illinois. Hey, Marty, what's up?
Not much. How you doing?
Good.
I just wanted to say I've had a lot of training with my gun, and I don't know what I'd do if someone came after me with a gun.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I'd hunker down, cry, run away, or what. And to teach teachers who already have so much on their plate to begin with, to teach them how to shoot a gun, I don't care how much training you have, do you actually want people who have never been shot at before to be spraying bullets where there's children around?
Right.
Makes no sense at all to me.
These people who are advocating this, and these teachers who are taking this training, and it's a very, very tiny number. I mean, it's a very, very tiny number. But nonetheless, they should first talk with a police officer who has been involved in a shooting or a military person who has been in a deployment in a war zone. Because you are absolutely right. When people are shooting at you, I can tell you, the only time in my life I've been in a situation where anybody was shooting at around me was I was in Uganda in 1980 during the tail end of the war with Idi Amin. And we were running a famine refugee center there, and one of the this woman named Anne from the Irish Red Cross was shot. Not right in front of me, but you know, around the time I was there. And you know, occasionally we would hear shots fired because Idi Amin had just fled the country. His army was still around. You know, bullets would come through every now and then, and people would just freak out. You know, people would run, people would scream. But you know, it's like, what do?
If you've never had, unless you're really
well trained. I mean, before you deploy people into combat, you train them in how to kill people and how to respond to fire.
And they still don't know how they're going to react when it actually happens.
You're absolutely right.
You have people in the Chicago police officers who have been trained to use their guns, and they still end up killing innocent bystanders because they're spraying lead all around.
Yeah, and in New York City, the same thing.
Or
overkill, you know, pumping all kinds of bullets into somebody who's got a wallet in his hand, you know, because...
Yeah, I mean, they've got all that adrenaline running through them. They don't know exactly what they're going to do until you're in that situation.
Yeah.
So to be training these teachers, you know...
Yeah, where I would see this going is just an absolute screaming tragedy. The first time some kid gets a BB gun or one of these plastic toy assault weapons for Christmas
and
decides to bring it into class and show it to the teacher, and the teacher thinks, oh, my God, this is it.
Yeah, pulls her gun and they start shooting, and... That's another tragedy.
Yeah, I mean, just imagine. I mean, the insanity, the very fact that the NRA would propose this and then the media would promote this, I find insane. Just insane. Marty, thank you for the call. And, you know, and thank you for the call as a sane gun owner. 27 minutes past the hour. What are we going to do about gun violence in the United States? You know, there's another dimension of this that nobody wants to talk about that I'm going to riff on briefly when we come back, and that's inequality. Why violence in society?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
As we become more rigid, as we get more billionaires, we become more violent. Is there a connection? Hour one and hour two the same thing? Okay, I want to get into inequality very briefly, but first, it's Geeky Science. Every Thursday for 3 minutes, I'm given permission by my producers to talk about science. So, you ever notice how when a basketball player starts draining shots, the rest of the team seems to step it up? Or when a baseball player goes on a hitting streak, his teammates try to follow suit? Well, according to a new study, success in baseball and other sports may actually be contagious. According to researchers at a software engineering firm in California, a baseball player who's on a hitting streak seems to lift the performance of his other teammates. The researchers analyzed the baseball statistics of teams on which someone got at least one hit in 30 consecutive games or more. Since 1945, there have been 28 of these streaks in Major League Baseball. On average, teammates of players who went on 30 or more full-game hitting streaks raised their own batting averages. In other words, the other players raised their own batting averages by 11 points during the streak when compared with the rest of the season. Researchers are quick to note that they didn't take certain factors into account, like the strength of the pitchers that they were facing or those kind of things. But despite the variables that may have been overlooked, other realms of sports seem to back up the success is contagious argument. Take, for example, Roger Bannister and his miraculous achievement of running a mile in under 4 minutes back in 1954. Prior to Bannister's feat, everyone said it was impossible. You can't run a four-minute mile. From doctors to scientists, everyone in between, the belief was the same. The sub-four-minute mile was simply not something that a human being could do. In the decades leading up to Bannister's 1954 achievement, under this umbrella of negativity, this belief system, thousands of runners tried to run a four-minute mile. They all failed. And then something funny happened. In the days, weeks, and years after Bannister hit that historic mark and broke the four-minute mile barrier, runner after runner broke the four-minute mile. What had been unattainable for so long suddenly became commonplace. So what happened? Apparently more important people began to believe that running a mile in under 4 minutes was possible after Bannister did it, and they began to do it too. So while it may not be possible to physically catch success like you catch a virus or the common cold, the story of the batters and the four-minute mile certainly goes a long way to show that success can be highly contagious. And that I think, is probably why the president is taking credit, and to their own people, Republicans are taking credit for this, for tax cuts that they, you know, now I think it's a meme that, you know, tax cuts produce stimulation that is not the very best out there. But still, if it's perceived as success, it will engender more. And I think, frankly, given the state of the Republican Party, that it was a success. So anyhow, Dean in Fernandon, I'm not saying that right, am I, Beach, Florida. Hey, Dean.
Hello.
How do
can you hear me?
I can hear you just fine. Is it Fernandina Beach?
Fernandina Beach. It's great. Right above Jacksonville.
Okay, so you and wanted to talk about...
I kind of disagreed with you. It's not really a disagreement.
Right.
You were talking with that lunatic who wants to put the guns in the schools, and you were talking about the Second Amendment and the reason for the Second Amendment, and you mentioned the Whiskey Rebellion, et cetera, et cetera. But it's always been my understanding, and from what I've read, the real reason for that wording in the Second Amendment was because we had an unprotected frontier, and people who were living in the frontier needed to defend themselves against the Indians. After the French and Indian War, if you remember, which was before the Revolution, the British took over Canada. The British were sitting up in Canada. And then after the Revolutionary War, many of the billionaires, and I've heard you talk about this, or Tories, moved to Canada.
You're right.
In between Canada and the United States were Indians. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these Indians, and I've heard you mention Samuel Johnson, the Johnson family in Schenectady, New York, mm-hmm. yeah. who were heavily involved and allied with the Iroquois Indians. Mm-hmm. And we had an unprotected frontier. And that is why...
I don't disagree with you that these weapons of war were used for the Indian genocide. But the Bill of Rights, I mean, anybody who's arguing the Second Amendment on this, again, Madison's piece was Madison 46. And basically what he said was, we're not so crazy as to worry about our own citizens trying to overthrow our government, basically. But the Second Amendment starts out, a well-regulated militia being necessary for the security of a free state. So you're suggesting that part of that security of the free state was the security from the Native Americans who were trying to defend themselves and their own land from the encroachment of the settlers. Okay. Yeah. Dean, that makes perfect sense to me. Thank you very much for the call, and thanks for putting that on the record. Till in Klickitat, Washington. It's amazing how many Native American names there are for cities in the United States. Till, what's up?
Yes, I was calling to talk about the First Amendment.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You're talking about, are you talking about the corporations like the Hobby Lobby that are claiming their First Amendment right to practice their religious freedom to discriminate against women?
Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof.
Right.
And it goes on, that
right.
one.
Right. But how is, are you...
Because the Bible is not religious.
It's not.
At all.
Okay.
No, in any way, shape, or form. In fact, it is anti-religion.
What?
Do you think that the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, is a religion?
I think that some people have elevated it to one, yeah. I think the people who say that we need to absolutely slavishly, attend to somebody's interpretation, Antonin Scalia's interpretation of the Constitution, or my interpretation of the Constitution, or whatever, that must be the way that it's supposed to be because the founders were somehow divinely inspired. They didn't think they were divinely inspired. They put a mechanism for amending the Constitution into the Constitution, and many of them argued that it should be easier to amend. So, I think that,
when
Tea Party.
When our forefathers wrote that, I don't think they could foresee what religion would become.
Oh, I think they had seen it.
Multi-billion-dollar industry that it has become.
Religion controlled the state of Massachusetts at the time of the founding of this republic. Ben Franklin left Massachusetts when he was 16 or 17 years old. He fled his family home and moved to Philadelphia because he was so sick and tired of the religious requirements of that state. You were required to pay a tax to support the church. Every Sunday, the local police went out and went from house to house. If you were found in your house, you were beaten or thrown into jail or fined. You had to be at church. You could not work on Sundays. If you worked, you were arrested or you were put in the stocks. The women who were suspected of witchcraft were drowned or burned or hanged. And this was, at the founding of the Republic. One of the big crises when the Constitution was being put together was around that piece of the First Amendment because the state of Massachusetts so strongly opposed it. Many of the delegates, many of the people from Massachusetts wanted to maintain a theocracy in Massachusetts. And, fortunately they didn't prevail. But I think that they had seen, it certainly wasn't, the fortunes that we see with, $1 billion in the hands of Pat Robertson. But, they had seen a variation on that in the day. But, Till, I get your point. Thank you for calling and sharing it with us. Dominic in Argyle, New York. Hey, Dominic.
Hey, Tom. How are you? Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
Just a couple of points that I wanted to make. One, you've consistently said that, the right wasn't intended for the purpose of overthrowing the government. And even if it were, we wouldn't make it. The countries that are out there now that are currently fighting for their rights, their freedoms, were only able to do so because of the individual's ability to have small arms.
And it's devastating those countries. It is absolutely devastating, and it is absolutely devastating those countries. If you look at the countries that have had successful revolutions by nonviolence, like India and South Africa, those were countries where the revolution was led by people like Gandhi and Nelson Mandela in South Africa. They were led by people who said, do not pick up arms. Do not carry weapons. We are going to do this nonviolently. I don't think that, if there was to be a revolution in the United States, I would hope that it was, and again, I see no purpose for it. We have a government that is us. We just, if we're going to have a revolution against anybody, it needs to be the billionaires who are corrupting our government. But if we were to, I would hope that it would be like the Indian or South African revolution of nonviolence rather than the Syrian or Egyptian revolution where people are killing each other.
I would hope so, too. But our founding fathers found it necessary when all else failed to have to do that. But that was just one point. The other point is, when you make the statement that, guns in a household are more likely to be used against its owner, by the inference, we would have to expect then that there would be 70 million people being killed on a regular basis because there are at least 150 million weapons in the hands of people in law-abiding households that don't use it against anybody, that are using it responsibly. More people use it responsibly than don't use it responsibly, even given the tragedies that we see today.
The statistics do not bear that out. And last year we had 10,480 murders by handgun, by guns. And it's we stand alone in the world in terms of gun violence in the United States. And it's not just murders, obviously. And in part, I believe that that's because we have so many guns. They're available, and there's an absolute correspondence. You find the states that have the most guns have the most gun violence. And the states that have the greatest inequality have the most gun violence, too. I think that inequality is a big piece of that. Dominic, thank you for your call. I respectfully disagree. We'll be back 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Check out our iPhone and iPad app, by the way, over at TomHartman.com. It's free, and you can get our daily blog on it and links to every story that we talk about, all kinds of cool stuff. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, exposing the con in conservative. 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Bob Ney is on the line with us with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Hey, Bob.
How are you?
I am great. Happy New Year to you. I haven't.
You too.
We haven't talked in the new year.
Yes, sir.
So what's going on in the world today?
Well, of course, John Boehner became the speaker again, but it wasn't easy. In fact, just looking at speakerships over the years, it was shocking in a sense.
Really? Tell me about this. Now, you're a former congressman. You know this stuff. I thought the only 13 people didn't vote for him among the Republican caucus and that was a great victory. But I don't know this stuff the way you do.
Yeah, he needed 220, and he got 220. He needed 214. Mm-hmm. So in terms of just internally, It's a bloody nose for him. And internally they're saying, you see? So to him, it's a hurt. Now, to the outside observers, he's a speaker and things, but internally in the politics of that conference, what they did was unheard of.
What'd they do? Really,
well, to not actually support him to that degree.
So was there a number of Republicans? What's the total number of Republicans in the House?
Well, he had 233 potential votes.
Okay.
So he ended up with 220. So 13 people either, didn't vote. Some of them didn't vote. A couple of them, or they voted against him.
Right.
And for him, that was a slap. It was a definite slap. It was a signal to him.
Right.
85 Republicans only voted for the fiscal cliff, and I argue they voted for that because of general elections, not because of primaries. Worried about general elections down the road.
Right. In other words, they're in a district where they don't think they're going to be facing a primary, but they are going to be facing a strong Democrat.
A strong.
Rather than a strong Tea Party.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And of course, because the bill itself, I think if people, once they start to realize what's in that bill, the bill itself is nothing to, as we say, write home about.
Yeah.
And I think that's, some of the displeasure with Boehner, too, of, what was in the bill, or maybe what wasn't.
Yeah. I was surprised that Eric Cantor didn't actually launch an attack against him. I thought Cantor was going to try and take away the speakership. Was I living on another planet, or did it almost happen?
I think that if the internal rebellion that, let's face it, that, was starting on the Hill, it was starting out there, maybe not by Cantor, but for Cantor, or aimed at putting Cantor in as speaker, who wants to be, and who would be the logical choice to run against Boehner, but it kind of fizzled out. Mm-hmm. Walter Jones of the Carolinas basically said, there was a movement that was started, so he kind of let the cat out of the bag on that, but it just simply didn't go anywhere. But six more votes, and there would have had to have been, there had been an emergency caucus, and there had been another round, and that may have caused somebody to say, we want Eric Cantor. So I look at that six votes as, to me, was pretty shocking.
Very interesting. Okay. So what else is going on?
Well, we got the fiscal cliff, which is, 77 million some people didn't get taken care of that, and that they're starting to wake up to that today with the payroll tax and the other things that are in it. But the big issue, too, was the, obviously, Hurricane Sandy, the furor, rightfully so, with Governor Christie and Peter King of New York. They bifurcated that bill, split the baby, as Solomon suggested, and $9 billion will be passed on Friday. The heat just generated up huge on Boehner. The rest of it will be passed on around January 15th, the rest of the 15-some billion. Fiscal cliff is ahead yet. The president says he's really not going to be engaged in that. Boehner today says he's not going to do a one-on-one with the president on future conversations. So everybody's kind of staking out their territory, but the debt ceiling, which was normally done without a peep, was such a furor previously for the president. And I think it's going to be made into that again, Tom.
Do you think that
the next battle?
Yeah, my belief is that the Republicans right now are thinking that if they can crash the economy, that the president will take the blame for it more than they will. And even if they do take some blame for it, you know, a year or two from now, there's a long, long time in politics and people will forget. And that they're willing to take that risk. That said, though, I'm guessing that the president's looking at the 14th Amendment and just saying, you know, this law that was passed back during World War I that said that, you know, Congress has to authorize paying the bills that it itself authorized, that it itself ran up, is a violation of the Constitution. The 14th Amendment says that the full faith and credit of the United States shall not be questioned. Do you think that he's going to be pulling the 14th Amendment out of his back pocket and waving it around?
No, he won't. He knows it, but he's not going to do it.
What's he going
to
do?
His comment, basically, to kind of paraphrase it, the president said he's not going to be engaged on this one. And so he's going to let the House, I guess, and Senate argue a bit about it. But I think that means he's not going to, you know, utilize what he could constitutionally on it.
What happens if the House simply refuses to vote to raise the debt ceiling? He can't direct the Treasury to... He can direct the Treasury to, you know, simply write the checks and say, sue me, I'll see you in court. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what the Constitution provides for.
Mm-hmm. He can do that.
But you're saying he's not going to do that. So what happens? He's going to let it crash, too?
I don't think he, even though he says he's not going to engage, I think he's got to step in at some point in time. But I don't think they're in a position where they want this to go back up to the edge like this thing did and the media hype on it, and then you produce a bill as they did, which was horrific.
Yeah.
I don't think that the Congress itself will be able to let that happen. Now, that means Boehner may have to make a deal again, because he was criticized by former Speaker Hastert today, Tom, he made a deal with the Democrats. Well, you know, so what? Even though I don't think the fiscal cliff bill was a good bill, but so what? You know, it's a process where sometimes both parties need to come together.
Well, that's called legislating.
Exactly. And Hastert criticized Boehner for that today. So
Hastert's not in office anymore. I mean, it's easy to throw stones from outside the House.
Exactly. And Hastert was no a great feat of courage anyway. He did everything President Bush told him to.
Yeah.
And he did. You know, I was there at that time. And so and when it comes to the debt ceiling, that's going to be the next battle. But they've got the farm bill and then the actual appropriations process. It's going to be a really rocky year.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service. Bob, I just heard you get stepped on. But, here's the LQ music. Bob, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thanks, sir.
And Happy New Year to you. The Talk Radio News Service brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Drop by and say hi. Tell them, send our greetings. We'll be back. It's coming up on the top of the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, what are you worried about? people say, what are you concerned about? You look into the future, you look into the next year, what do you see? What I see is Greece. What I see is Spain. What I see is the United Kingdom. What I'm seeing played out in the United States right now and being set up for this year is what Naomi Klein famously called disaster capitalism. The rich get richer, the working class gets screwed. Consider it's just some really simple foundational concept. You've got all these Republicans running around hysterically screaming about our debt. our national debt is not costing us a tremendous amount of money right now because our government can borrow really, really cheap. And even if it did, I mean, there are a whole bunch of different solutions for it. But the easiest solution, the best way to pay down the debt is not to cut spending. It's not even to raise taxes. It's to grow the economy. We have 20 million people unemployed or underemployed. If we moved 20 million people from a situation where they're getting food stamps or where they're actually it's over 40 million on food stamps from a situation where they're making so little that they qualify for food stamps. In other words, if we raise the minimum wage to $12 an hour. Move people from getting government benefits to paying taxes. Your debt problem would be solved, or at least your deficit problem would be solved. Nobody's talking about this. In the last 2 years, the Republicans in Congress, they've passed hundreds of bills that have to do with female contraception. They passed and marriage and, you know, gays and they were the first piece of legislation that was proposed today in the House of Representatives. I think this is incredibly symbolic of the whole thing. Was it a jobs bill? Because there wasn't a single jobs bill passed out of the House of Representatives in the last 2 years. Was it anything that would stimulate the economy? Anything that would put anybody back to work? No. It was Michelle Bachmann's proposal to end Obamacare. Right. But if you want the economy to recover, we have to grow our way out of it, and we have to grow our way out of it in ways that are rational and sane and not destructive of planet Earth, which is increasingly becoming a thread that needle kind of thing. Our trade deficit right now is $1 billion a day. That's not our budget deficit. That's our trade deficit. That's the amount of money that we're buying. That's the amount of stuff that we're buying from countries overseas, companies that are manufactured overseas, and bringing into the United States. That's the number of dollars that are going out that then stand as debt as well. We need to change our trade policies. If we changed our trade policies, many of these companies that have sent jobs overseas would bring them back. If we simply said, that's it, we're going to go with a VAT tax. Russia has a VAT tax. China has a VAT tax. Germany, France, Spain. You go through the list. Pretty much everybody has a VAT tax except us. What is a VAT tax? It's a value-added tax. It's where you tax manufactured goods at each stage along the process of manufacture. Every time value is added to it, that is taxed. So the iron ore being turned into iron is taxed. Very small, but taxed. From iron to steel, it's taxed. From steel to flat steel, it's taxed. From flat steel to a car door, it's taxed. From a car door to a car, it's taxed. And then you end up with an accumulative VAT tax of anywhere from, 10 to 30% is the typical range in the advanced democracies around the world. And when you export something, you can reverse out the VAT tax. In other words, it becomes a subsidy for exports. And when somebody wants to import something, you say, okay, well, there were 22 stages of production and manufacturing that thing before it got to the United States. We're going to VAT tax every one of them. And now it becomes a 10, 15, 20% import tariff. We understand import tariffs in the United States. We used them from 1793 until basically the Reagan era. And they worked. Well, since the WTO and GATT and all this stuff, declared that you can't have import tariffs anymore, we stupidly said, okay, we'll just do away with them. And everybody else said, okay, fine, we'll do away with them. Oh, by the way, we're going to impose VAT taxes at the border on imports. So if we did just like really simple stuff, except that it's not simple because it would work in the best interest of our country. It would stimulate our economy. It would put people back to work. And particularly if we targeted industries like, hey, wind power, solar power, localizing power, smart grids, bringing the internet up to speed, pass a law that says that whoever has the infrastructure, if it passes through public rights of way, has to make it available to any company that wants to use it so that You know, you can buy your cell phone service from 50 different companies instead of two. You can buy your internet service from 100 different companies or 1,000 different companies instead of three. You can buy your phone service from 50 different countries instead of one. You can buy your electric power from 10 or 15 different generators rather than just one. If we did that, which most other countries in the world have done, we would be moving faster. We would be building an economy. We could be building an economy based on green sources of energy and on information. We could put this country back together, and we could do it in a year or two. This is a major project, but this is not something that's going to take generations. I mean, it's taken 30 years for Reaganomics to totally decimate the American middle class. But I think we could undo an awful lot of that really fast. But you don't fix the economy by so-called, you know, solving the debt crisis. And if your solution to solve the debt crisis is to cut spending, which is, of course, what, you know, the Cato Institute, formerly the Charles Koch Foundation, is out there promoting, and the Heritage Foundation and the Koch brothers, these billionaire funded organizations are, oh, we got to worry about the deficit. This is just this is Jude Winiski's two Santa Claus theory. This is pure partisan Republican politics combined with disaster capitalism that helps out billionaires and transnational corporations and totally screws the middle class. There's no other way to describe it. And the people are waking up. You've seen two populist eruptions in the last 3 or 4 years, the Tea Party movement and the Occupy movement. And they're characterized as being on the right and on the left. And I would submit to you that both of them are people simply saying, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore, and acting it out in ways that are generationally specific. Tea Partiers is mostly boomers. The Occupy movement is mostly people who are in their 20s. But they're both saying the same thing. We know this isn't working. We're not sure exactly what the solution is, but we know who the bad guys are. They're clearly the banksters. We know that billionaires shouldn't be able to buy politicians. I mean, if you go to movetoamend.org, is one of David Cobb loves to talk about this. He's one of the guys who put this thing together, move to amend the Constitution to say corporations aren't people and money isn't speech. They draw people from the Occupy movement and from Tea Party groups into the same meeting room and march out together saying we're going to amend the Constitution, because this is screwing all of us. So if we go into this year, and mark my words, this is probably one of the most important things that I've said that I've said so far this year. If we go into this year focusing on austerity, focusing on cutting, focusing on trying to balance the budget by cutting, we are going to end up in a double dip recession like the UK is right now, or worse, like Spain.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And on the other hand, if we spend money on stimulus and we put money into a green economy and we put some banksters in jail and break up the big banks, we're going to move ahead like Iceland is. Welcome back to the place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, not a chance. Not a chance. So here's the thing. We've got a middle class that's been wiped out. The wealth of the middle class, which was largely in their homes, has been largely wiped out, although it's very slowly starting to recover. But the middle class is still sinking. Yeah, I mean, look at GM. Oh, we bailed out GM. Isn't it wonderful? New hires are coming in at what, 14, 15 bucks an hour at the most? I mean, it's a start. But we are looking at a radical recalibration of the American dream, of the American standard of living, as the consequence of 32 years of Reaganomics. And I am waiting for some national politician to have the courage to stand up and say Reagan was wrong. And frankly, with regard to free trade, Clinton was wrong. That it is time to have America for Americans. Let's pursue a populist agenda, a genuinely populist agenda. And let's stimulate this economy by building our physical and intellectual infrastructure in a way that is absolutely green and sustainable. I don't get, you know, why communist China can have a high-speed rail system. This is a country, I lived in China for a month in November of 1987. I studied at the Beijing International Acupuncture Hospital, teaching hospital, 500-bed hospital. And I studied acupuncture for a month. It was just a curiosity. It was fascinating. And the country was so poor at that time that, you know, living in this hospital for a month, it was like $260, as I recall. And there was room, board, a one-on-one doctor, a one-on-one translator. It was amazing. I mean, I shared a room with three other people, one of them a physician from Colombia, from Bogota, who has, you know, we still stay in touch. A good friend. He's now a practicing psychiatrist at Bellevue in New York City. But in any case, it was just, you know, the country was so poor. I stood in front of Tiananmen Square on this main street, this big, you know, eight-lane both ways street, and just this ocean of bicycles, and maybe once every 4 or 5 minutes a single car would go by. There were no high-rise buildings. The highest building in all of Beijing was either the Hilton or the Sheraton, and it was 8 or 10 stories high. And it had the fanciest restaurant, and there was a steakhouse on the roof, and they had a pizzeria, and that was it. You could buy lunch for a penny and a half, U.S. And they went from that, dirt streets, in every street in every neighborhood, all the neighborhoods around the hospital that I was living in, you know, it was just residential areas. In every street there would be a big pile. This was in November, so it was the early winter, right? In every street there would be a big pile of coal briquettes. And people would just heat one room of their house. And the whole city had this kind of gray haze over it from people burning coal. That was the capital. That was Beijing, China, 1987. 25 years ago, more or less, if I'm doing my math right. And they went from that to just laying down the equivalent of a rail line from New York City to Miami, or from New York to Chicago, where that train can travel over 300 miles an hour and make that trip in a half a day. I mean, compete with airlines at a very low cost, as the train companies are fond of pointing out to us. They can move a ton of goods 400 miles on a gallon of fuel. Why? Because locomotive engines are hybrid. Yes, they are hybrid. They're actually electric engines with diesel generators. And as they slow down, they recapture that energy and put it back in their batteries. So, but I digress. I mean, why is it that we are not leading the world? It's because we got stupid. And it's not, part of our getting stupid was Reaganomics. It was this ideology, this weird belief that Milton Friedman and Ayn Rand and all these right-wing economic theorists were right, that the economy should be completely unregulated, let the billionaires run everything, and it'll work out just fine. After all, that's how it did in the Gilded Age, didn't it? Well, actually, no. The longest and worst depression in the history of the United States was in the period from 1874 until around 1898. We refer to it as the Gilded Age, but it was also, the people who lived through it knew it as the Great Depression. It was the longest and worst depression in American history. It was far worse than the depression of the 1930s. Christopher Freeland documents this brilliantly in her new book, Plutocrats, by the way, if you're interested in this kind of history. And then we got smart in the 1930s, and Franklin Roosevelt said, why don't we start building stuff? Why don't we put people to work? Why don't we say that, you know, you have a right to a job, and if capitalism won't provide it for you, government will. That rather than giving people food stamps and welfare checks, we're going to give them a job. If they can't work, we'll take care of them. But if they can work, we'll give them a job. That's the best welfare program. In fact, I'm paraphrasing Roosevelt. Roosevelt said the best welfare program is a job. Now, I realize there's this group that says, oh, government, you know, that's big government. Government's going to get bigger if you do that. That's a terrible thing. No, it's not a terrible thing. That's putting your economy back together. We did that in this country. We've done that in this country several times, as a matter of fact. And it's worked just fine. And then we go into these periods of laissez-faire right-wing capitalism, as we did in during the Gilded Age, as we did in the 1920s, and as we've done since Reagan. And what does it do? Every single time it crashes the economy. So if we want to fix our economy, we need to do something about inequality. We need to be raising taxes on the, I'm talking about rolling back the Reagan tax cuts. We need wages to be increased. I'm talking about the ability of people to form labor unions by simply checking a mark on a card and saying, yes, I want to join. Sign me up. And they don't have to sit through years of classes and indoctrination by their employer about how horrible the union's going to be. They can make up their own damn mind. I'm talking about a minimum wage that's actually a livable wage. I mean, just basic stuff.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And once again, how did we get so stupid? Because it serves the interests of multinational corporations and the billionaires who run them. And if we're talking about austerity this year, we're screwed. Good, the bad, and the very, very nefandously ugly, the good. Illinois Republican Chairman Pat Brady. This week, lawmakers in Illinois are considering a bill that would legalize marriage equality in that state. Of course, many have come out against the bill, but surprisingly, Mr. Brady is not one of them. The state Republican chairman called state lawmakers yesterday, both Democrats and Republicans, urging them to support the bill. Brady told a local newspaper, quote, "I think it's time for people to support this." Yeah, it's time that all Republicans stood with Mr. Brady and recognize that marriage equality is a basic right that should be afforded to all Americans. The bad. New Hampshire State Representative Dan Dominey. Democrats in the New Hampshire State House of Representatives passed a bill banning lawmakers from bringing concealed weapons into the House chamber, and that's not sitting well with Granite State Republicans like Dan Dominey. After the vote, Dominey told a local newspaper, a New Hampshire newspaper, that a holstered gun is not a deadly weapon. But anything can be used as a deadly weapon. A credit card can be used to cut somebody's throat. I don't know what's worse here. The fact that Republicans in New Hampshire think they need to be locked and loaded in the state capitol, or the fact that they're seriously making the argument that a credit card is just as deadly as a gun. And the very, very ugly, John Watson. Watson, the CEO of Chevron, America's second largest oil company, wants nothing to do with helping to save the environment. He told the AP that big oil companies like Chevron should focus on providing affordable energy from oil, coal, and gas, and leave protecting the environment and combating global warming to the government. And when asked by the AP about the best way to reduce America's carbon emissions, Watson all but deflected the question. So as our environment and country continue to suffer from the horrendous consequences of climate change, big oil CEOs like John Watson are content with watching their companies spew more and more toxic chemicals, and that is very, very ugly. That's mind-bogglingly ugly. Dave in Fort Collins, Colorado, listening on AM 760. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I just wanted to share a quick number with you. I was talking with a police officer, and he told me that the accepted statistic for trained police officers that fire their weapon when under fire is that they hit their target 1 out of 5 times.
That sounds pretty good,
now,
actually. In a high adrenaline situation.
If we hold kindergarten teachers to that same standard, which is questionable at best, I think, that means that if you have a kindergarten teacher with a 15-shot clip, 12 of those bullets are going somewhere in that school other than in the person who's shooting at them.
You're right.
I don't think that's an acceptable number.
No. I totally agree with you, and that's a brilliant way of pointing it out, Dave. Thank you very much for calling and sharing that with us. Very well said. Steve in Amarillo, Texas. Hey, Steve, what's up? You want to talk about the fiscal cliff?
I don't think the Democrats and progressives really know how to bargain when they go as far as the fiscal cliff. We should never really get what we ask for, and what I mean by that is, if we wanted 250, why didn't we start at 175?
Yeah. Well,
because
you know, logic would indicate that.
If we're getting what we asked for, it doesn't make any sense.
It may be that all along Obama was saying 250, figuring that, you know, he'd settle for 400, 450. You know,
frankly, maybe in his mind he said, I'll go to 450, but I'm going to start at 250.
Yeah, frankly, it's not that big a deal. It's like, I feel the same way about the inheritance tax. It's like, you know, there's this big, you know, fight about, oh, gee, it's at $5 million, you know, some people want to take it down to $1 million. I don't have a problem if it goes to $10 or $15 million. The estates, or even 20 or 50, frankly, because the estates that are corrosive to democracy, the people who are inheriting large amounts of money, the Richard Mellon scapes of the world, the people who are inheriting massive amounts of money and then using that to corrupt politics, they don't have $5 million estates. They have $5 billion right. estates. And yeah, you know, so, sure. you know, that, so I, this is, you know, my big gripe with the tax, you know, if to the extent that it's a gripe, I mean, I frankly don't think that there's any way, given the power of Wall Street right now because of Citizens United, that the president or anybody else could have gotten the Democratic and Republican Party to vote for legislation that didn't give tax breaks to banksters. In other words, kept the capital gains and carried interest loopholes intact. But that's my big gripe, is that right now people who make, you know, anywhere from $1,000 a year to several hundred thousand dollars a year, maybe, you know, up to $300,000-$500,000 a year, they're going to pay up to 39.6% income tax. But people who make millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars a year, and yes, there are thousands of people like that in the United States, billions of dollars a year, the vast majority of them do not take that as a paycheck. They don't take deduction. You know, it's not like, you know, their taxes are deducted from their paycheck. Instead of taking it as a paycheck, they take it by virtue of stock options, which they sell, and then they call that a capital gain, and their maximum tax rate is set now at 20%. And so, you know, you've got people like the surgeon that saved my wife's life is going to be paying 39%, income tax on his income, assuming that he makes over $400,000 a year. I don't know, but, you know, he may well. And frankly, I don't have a problem with that. And on the other hand, you've got, you know, the guy down on Wall Street who just happened to be able to get the building closer to the main stock exchange than the guy next to him, whose computer can trade, you know, 1.5 million trades a second rather than 1.2 million trades a second, making $1 billion a year and paying 20% income tax on it. That's my problem. And again, we're not going to fix that until we fix Citizens United, and we're not going to fix Citizens United until either one of the five right wingers on the Supreme Court retires and is replaced by President Obama, and thank God we've got a Democrat in the White House, or until we amend the Constitution of the United States. And for that, you got to go to movetoamend.org. Steve, thank you for the call. Well thought out call. I appreciate it. Robert in Mission Viejo, California. Hey, Robert, what's up? You wanted to talk about guns?
Yeah. You know, first of all, I want to say that politically, both of us who agree with gun control, we have a big problem, because when we say to Bubba, Bubba, you don't need that gun, what Bubba hears is, I don't trust you. Mm-hmm. And after that, you don't have an ally. It's hard to come back from that.
Yeah.
But here's the other thing, too. You know, what really protects us from an abusive government is not guns. Our vote is what protects us from an abusive government.
You're absolutely right.
And
it's not just our vote. It's showing up to vote. And that's
right,
one of the problems
right,
that
yeah,
we have, is that so few Americans
right.
actually participate.
Right. But here's the thing, too. I mean, and here at the fundamental basic, like at the point of the pulling of the trigger, what protects you from an abusive government is the fact that a Marine sniper will not shoot you if you don't have a gun. So here's my suggestion to my friends who think that they're going to defend themselves with their gun. This is the appropriate way to defend yourself when faced with a Marine sniper. You put the gun in a safe direction, drop the magazine, empty the chamber, grab the gun by the barrel, throw it as far as you can from yourself, get down on the ground and wait for him to tell you what to do, and then do it.
Which is, you know, without the whole preface of what you do with the gun, is what Gandhi did. I mean, I am astounded that all these people who think that they need guns to protect themselves from the government, that they've got some kind of revolution in the back of their mind that they think is going to happen. Many of them, in fact, most of them call themselves Christian, and they don't acknowledge that this major revolution against the Roman Empire that was launched by a group of revolutionary Jews led by this guy named Jesus, that it was a nonviolent revolution, that he was willing to die for the revolution rather than pick up arms. That when Peter pulled his sword out and cut a guy's ear off, he said, "Don't do that, put that sword away." That Gandhi, when he overthrew the mightiest empire on earth, the British Empire, as the leader of a nonviolent movement in India, did so by sitting down in the street. That Martin Luther King, when he really brought civil rights to a head here in the United States with the civil rights movement, did so not by shooting at people, not by yelling at people, but by speaking with people and by standing there he and others who were involved in that movement, by standing there and saying, "Turn the water hoses on, bring on the dogs, bring on the billy clubs, we will not be moved. Not we're going to shoot your butt. We will not be moved."
And you can trust our Marines. They have more integrity than all the politicians combined.
I think you're right. Robert, thank you for the call. Dale in Alpena, Michigan. Hey, Dale.
Hi. I have a couple comments.
If you could, we just have a minute to the break, Dale. If you could make it quick.
The
please.
One on the guns in school, if mm-hmm. my girls were still in school, I would take them out and I would homeschool them. That is just totally ridiculous.
But the odds of dying in school are 1 in 2 million, as a caller earlier shared with us. The odds of dying in a car accident, 1 in 8,000. I mean, it's schools are one of the safest places in America right now, even with what has happened.
Yeah. Well, as far as them giving teachers guns, I don't agree with that.
That's crazy. If my school had guns and my kids were in that school, I would pull them out and homeschool them. I'd be with you, Dale. But right now, the kids are much more likely to be killed in their home if there is a gun in the neighborhood. Not even in their home, but just in the neighborhood. They're much more likely to be killed in their home than they are to be killed in their school. So, we have to keep these things in perspective. But thank you for the call, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We will be back. It's 45 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman program. Once again, just a simple call. Let's all recognize that austerity is a program being promoted by international banksters that is ruining Europe, and now the Republican Party wants to bring it to America.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
As we go through this year, every time you hear somebody talking about we've got a spending problem, that's code for they want to impose austerity. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Kirk in Bothell, Washington. Hey, Kirk, what's on your mind? Thanks for listening to 91.3 FM, by the way.
Yeah, that's why I called. It's just such a treat to hear your voice in crystal clear FM. I listened to you for 8 years on KPTK, and we're all sad about the demise of that progressive station. But we have you on KBCS, and hopefully maybe some others will follow. KBCS is a great community station, and it's a really nice fit for the Tom Hartman Show. I'm just so happy to hear you, Tom. Thanks.
Well, thank you, Kirk, and thanks for listening to KBCS, and we're very happy to be on the air there. It's a real treat. Dave in Yulee, Florida, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. You know, I think people sometimes have a hard time wrapping their mind around exactly how much a billion with a B, billion dollars is.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if you do the math on just $3 billion, if you had that kind of money, you know, some 10,000 years ago, you would still be living on that money at $50,000 a year. Now, it's 10,000 years ago, back when dinosaurs roamed the earth. You would still be living on
that
today.
That was the beginning of the agricultural revolution. That was the very first farming was 10,000 years ago. Yeah, you're right.
Like back during the Iroquois Indians or whatever.
Oh, long before that. Iroquois were just a couple.
That's a long time ago.
Yeah.
I mean, these people are like hoarders with their money.
I believe that's the case.
Like those people you see on TV that have, you know, all the books and the bugs and the, you know, animal species all over the house. These people are like hoarders with money.
Yep, You're absolutely right. And it looks a little more sanitary because you can hoard your money in the bank. And but, you know, they check the balance every day. Let's check it 4 or 5 times a day. I believe you're right, David. And I've said this many times. I think that, you know, there are some people who are wealthy and it's just like, hey, you know, that's the case. There are other people who are wealthy and they're suffering, actually. And I've known a couple of them who are literally suffering from obsessive compulsive disorder. They have this obsession, this compulsion to hoard money. And it dominates their lives, and they need to get therapy. Thank you, Dave, for the call. John in Folsom, California. Hey, John, you want to talk about the Constitution?
Well, yes, sir. The Second Amendment is probably one of the shortest ones of the Bill of Rights,
mm-hmm.
and it says a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state.
That's right.
The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed.
Yep.
Well, the key here is a well-regulated militia,
mm-hmm.
and to me, that's the National Guard.
Yep.
And
in fact, I've suggested that we should, if Obama wanted to do something that was really powerful, or the Democrats in Congress, just pass a very simple piece of legislation that renames the National Guard as the National Militia State version. So you've got the Michigan State Militia, the Virginia State Militia, the New York State Militia, and stop calling them National Guards and start calling them state militias. And then everybody will go, click, oh, now I understand.
Well, but these people that bend the Second Amendment to fit their mindset about some tyrannical government that's going to oppress them, they just can't wait to shoot their guns.
Yeah.
And this is dangerous in this country to have this, and I certainly hope the FBI, and I'm sure they are infiltrating these groups because they're on the edge. And I think a lot of this, all these shootings in the last 10 years, 15 years, is just a symptom of a sick society.
Here's the problem, John. It's not the FBI who's supposed to infiltrate them. It's the ATF, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. Firearms being the F and ATF.
Okay.
And for 8 years, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms has not had a director. Because Republicans will not, because they 9 years ago, the Republicans passed legislation saying that this had to be, the directorship of the ATF had to be confirmed by the Senate. And then for 8 years, they have refused to confirm a director. And the budget for the ATF, which is established by the House of Representatives, but it has to be concurred with by the Senate. In other words, the Republicans have been able to control that, too. The budget for the ATF has not only been frozen over the last eight years, but many parts of it, particularly those parts that have to do with enforcement of the gun laws and looking into guns, have been diminished. Laws have been actually passed by Congress saying that it's illegal for the federal government to keep records of who owns guns in the United States. I mean, it's absolutely bizarre when you look at all these rules and laws that have been put on the books to basically neuter the ATF. And why? Because the NRA wants it that way, because the gun lobby wants it that way, because the largest seller of guns in the United States, Walmart, wants it that way, because the gun manufacturers want it that way. So I'm totally with you on this. Thank you for the call. Bob in Orlando, Florida. Hey, Bob, you want to talk about the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act?
Yeah, Tom Harkin. By the way, before I do that, please read the book Heavenly Discourse by Charles Erskine Scott Wood. Best read I've ever had, written in 1926. Same problem, same answer. It's all the philosophers in heaven talking with Teddy Roosevelt and things like that. And please.
Heavenly Discourse. Okay, I'm making a note.
It's like, yeah, please, and you'll call me up in the middle of the night thanking me.
Okay.
Now this is a little weird, but, you know, Tom Harkin, we got the ADA. And we have a lot of things like springs in the paper today. The springs are being poisoned in Florida. Now, if we make the springs corporations and make them disabled, then we can sue under the ADA because all these entities, these physical thing entities, now the atmosphere around my house, the atmosphere.
Oh, I see what you're saying. So if we made the environment a corporation, then it could be protected.
By ADA, because it's sick. We can prove that we're disabled. The environment's disabled.
Right, because if a corporation is entitled to free speech, according to Scalia and Roberts and Thomas, then it's entitled to religion, according to the Seventh Circuit Court. And if it's entitled to free speech and religion, then it's entitled to protection under the Americans with Disabilities Act. If it's disabled, yeah, it's an interesting logic chain, Bob. I like it. Thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for listening to Sirius Satellite Radio. We'll be back tomorrow. It's Friday, of course, so tomorrow will be our first Brunch with Bernie of 2013. America Senator, Senator Bernie Sanders, will be here talking about all the important issues of the week and answering your questions, too. Plus, anything goes on Town Hall Friday. What's on your mind this week? And the best of the rest of the news, along with your calls here on the Tom Hartman Program, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week for we the people. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It begins with you. Get out there, get active, occupy something, tag your it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.